We all know that the church and the world are in crisis today. How does a Catholic navigate these storms without losing their faith in God? That's going to be today's topic on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to the channel. That lets other people know about what we're doing here. So if you like what we're doing, make sure you like this episode, subscribe to the channel, hit your notifications, all those things that you know what to do. So, okay, let's go ahead and get started. Our guest today is Father Gerald Murray. He is the pastor of Holy Family Church in New York City. Father Murray has appeared as a commentator on religious topics on various television and radio outlets, including EWTN, EWTN Spanish, Fox News, Fox Business News, MSNBC, New York One, Radio Maria, Fox News Radio, and The Voice of America. He is fluent in French, Spanish, and Italian, has a working knowledge of Portuguese. He served in the U.S. Naval Reserve Chaplain Corps from 1994 to 2005. And he is the author, and this is what we'll be speaking about today, he's the author of the upcoming book, Calming the Storm, Navigating the Crises Facing the Catholic Church and Society, from Emmaus Road Publishing. Welcome to the program, Father.
Thank you, Eric. Good to be with you.
Yeah, this is, of course, perfect for Crisis Magazine, because we're talking about how we navigate these crises. That's exactly what Crisis Magazine has been trying to do since 1982, when we were first founded. Now, before we get... why don't we just start off immediately with the title of the book? It says Calming the Storm. So how would you describe the storm that's raging today? What is this storm you're talking about?
Well, the storm, as the subtitles describes, is a storm of crises facing the church and society. So the storm, in my estimation, basically comes down to a rejection of God and a rejection of his creation. So it's the loss of faith. And then it's also the loss of confidence in the intelligibility of the universe, in the rational order of the created world, and of man's ability to both understand the purpose of creation and then put it to good use. So we're basically adrift in our current social scene and the life of the church. Many of the doctrines that the church has taught as being revealed by God are either rejected or ignored by many, including prominent churchmen. So, you know, you can say we've got a five-alarm fire going on in the world, and the church, the flames are also, unfortunately, causing a lot of damage in that area.
Right. Now, what would you say is the root cause that made this happen? Because obviously, we know, at least it's pretty easy to see that we've started these crises in the 1960s, but of course there's a lot of indications of things going wrong before that. What would you say kind of caused our current storm that we're going to, and how do we get to this point that we're rejecting God, a loss of faith, a loss of sense of sin, and all these things?
Yeah, in the book we trace it back. Of course, original sin is at the root of all problems in human existence, but the particular manifestations that we're seeing now, they go back to the Reformation, the Renaissance, a worldly spirit. And then for our own particular crises in the Western world, it's the French Revolution. And it is the overthrow of not simply human authority, but also the rejection of divine authority as being, let's say, the point of reference for all human decision making. Now the point of reference becomes man and his desires. So what people want is now becoming a reality as opposed to the real order of things. In our own country, the French Revolution did not have as much of an effect, certainly over the course of time. The American Revolution is a completely different experience. But the post-World War II era has been, unfortunately, a time where French revolutionary ideas that were circulating in the intellectual world in Europe made a great foothold. And we now basically live in a world of academic skepticism and rationalism. And then, unfortunately, in the church, a desire, we could call it Me Too-ism, that the church wants to be as modern as the secular society around us. That's just led to a slew of problems, and we can talk about them, but they are intellectually rooted in this rationalistic spirit in which God is no longer the measure of man. Man is the measure of everything.
It reminds me of the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision where the court said that basically, I can't remember the exact wording, but we can define our concept of existence. We can define, and so therefore, obviously you can kill babies in the womb because you can just define that that's okay. You can define it's not a baby, whatever the case may be. And of course, we see that really today with the fact that a man can declare himself a woman, and now all of a sudden that's what we're supposed to accept. I mean, a lot of these things are go back to this idea where man is the determining factor, not God. Is that essentially what you're saying here?
Oh yes, exactly. And that's that decision was about, you know, at the core of liberty is the ability for each one to determine the meaning of life. You know, so Justice Scalia called it the oh sweet meaning of life, oh sweet mystery of life. Jokingly referring to a bit, it's a completely disreputable idea that the meaning of life depends on what I or you or anyone else determines. It's the other way around. Our life can have meaning if we understand reality as it is, you know, being firmly rooted and grounded. And that's the role of tradition in society. It's the role of social norms and taboos. It's certainly the role of the law. You know, Justice Scalia was very clear. The Constitution is not a living document. Documents are written down on paper. They're not living. In other words, they don't evolve and change. The meaning of the words has to be understood. And I think that's what we're facing now in the church. We recently had a cardinal in Luxembourg say the teaching of the Catholic Church on homosexuality is wrong. Now, how any cardinal of the world can say that with, you know, self-respect for his role as a cardinal. But what he's saying then means the Catholic Church for 2,000 years has gotten it wrong on a matter of essential importance. What is moral, what is immoral, that everything's wrong up till now. Well, there is an example of saying we get to determine what reality is and you all have to agree with us and go along with it.
Right. So, let's focus a little bit then. We know that things are crazy in the world, but let's really focus on the church because things are crazy in the church too. And what's going on here in the book, you Calming the Storm, you talk a lot about the confusion going on in the church. And I think sometimes Catholics interpret that to faithful Catholics interpret that to mean, are you kind of giving an out? Like it's just confusion. Wouldn't you say that there's been at times it's not confusing, for example, what that cardinal in Luxembourg said. He's simply just stating heresy. I guess what I'm trying to ask is there efforts to purposely cause confusion in the church in order to get through things that are heretical or evil or things like that? Does that make sense?
No, it does. And, you know, let's say, an example of confusion, if there's a sandstorm, then you're confused what direction you're supposed to walk in, or, you know, where is the house, where's the street, and where's the sidewalk. The sandstorm causes confusion. Now, sandstorm is caused by no one, so it's just a phenomenon. But in the church, now we have this bishop, for instance, this cardinal saying that homosexuality is good, it's not wrong. That causes people to question in their mind, well, what am I supposed to believe in? Because the cardinal is the one we were taught we're supposed to listen to. You know, when a bishop teaches, he's fulfilling his role, and I guess I have to go along with it. So people get confused. Other people, you know, who want the teaching to be wrong, in other words, those that think homosexual lifestyle is good, you know, they're going to go around and say, well, guess what, folks? Your idea about morality has been rejected by the leadership of the church. Therefore, you know, you're free to change your opinions. And in fact, you're not only free to change it, you got to, because I want you to recognize my homosexual lifestyle as equal and as good as marriage. So, yeah, confusion is not simply something that happens like the weather. It's caused by people. And that's where, you know, the serious fault lies right now. And we have to recognize this and not pretend that this is not being caused by some people's actions and words.
Right. Now, there's debate in the church sometimes about kind of who's to blame for this. I know a lot of lay Catholics want to simply blame the bishops. It's the bishop's fault. And I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm sympathetic to that point. But then others would say, well, the bishops come out of the laity. Obviously, a bishop at one point was a lay person in a lay family. So if they're not being raised properly by a good Catholic family, then they're going to end up being problematic. Others just would say, you know, it's just a corrupt world. We're part of it. I mean, where would you say, and I do think it, I'm not just doing to lay blame, but in order to fix it in the future. Where would you say inside the church, the cause of these, this confusion, where should we look to first to kind of to lay blame, to at least try to correct the problem going forward?
Well, you know, you have the history of heresy in the church. Right from the beginning, there have been people who deny doctrines of the faith for various reasons. And in the modern age, a lot of the heresy has to do with sexual morality. And that, you know, is very unfortunate, because if ever there was a time when the world needed a corrective, it's our own. But what's revealed is that there's a worldly spirit which believes in, you know, evolving dogmas, you know, dogmas not fixed once and for all in time when it's written down, its meaning is doesn't stand for the rest of history. No, there's a group of people out there who say, well, it was true back then when they wrote it, but it's no longer true now. And they'll say, if you're going to be a Catholic who is going to be effective in the modern world, you have to dialogue and engage the modern world on its own terms. And I'll be the first one to say, yes, we want to have a relationship with the modern world, but it's not simply following along with it. We're here to instruct, admonish, and critique, and then support what's good. Because, you know, modernity has many good aspects to it, and the church doesn't condemn it as such. But we do condemn this modern spirit that is right now, you know, dominant in the media and academia in the U.S., which is you can do whatever you want, as long as you don't hurt someone else, and you can be whatever you think you are, and no one has a right to contradict you. That problem in the church is now, you know, located in the hierarchy. You know, the bishop in Luxembourg, the cardinal, not the only one in Europe. Other bishops have gone incredibly off the reservation, we could say, but really just abandoning Christ and his teaching because they want to be in line with this modern thinking. This is terrible.
Yeah, and I'd say also it's like there's certain bishops like this Cardinal Luxembourg who's obviously just explicitly saying let's change unchangeable church teaching. But it seems like there's a lot of bishops, a lot of American bishops, I think would fall into this, that they're not going out and saying that. They're probably even personally relatively Orthodox, but they seem to be afraid to say anything against the modern world, because we both know if they do, they will get hammered. They'll get hammered by media. They'll get hammered by a lot of Catholics in the pews, frankly. And so what can we do to help the bishops understand that you sometimes are going to have to say things that you're not going to be popular, but you have to say them, because otherwise we just get run over by the heretical bishops and the people outside the church.
Right. Well, we have to encourage our bishops to be bold shepherds. You know, when the wolves show up, it's not the job of the shepherd to say, well, there are only three wolves out there. And, you know, most of the pasture land is clear. So we hope they don't take too many of our sheep. No, we have to fight the wolves. And if the wolves are in shepherd's clothing, meaning they're pretending to be transmitting their job as a messenger of Christ, we have to say, unmask them as being, you know, essentially fraudulent. If a cardinal doesn't believe the Catholic moral teaching is obligatory and true, he should resign, because that's what he signed up to do. He did not sign up to teach his own opinions. And, you know, one of the disappointing things from my perspective is that after this cardinal issued this statement, which has gotten wide circulation in the Catholic media, very few authority figures in the church have criticized him. You know, I can think of no bishops' conference that has come out and condemned his words. Very few individual bishops seem to have spoken about it. You know, it's remarkable. If this bishop had made some kind of statement, you know, alleging, you know, racist ideology or some other outrageous, horrible idea, I don't know there'd be this much passivity. But if you're going to offend the current, you know, false notions about the nature of man and homosexual activity, then suddenly you keep quiet. It's terrible. It's disheartening to the average layman, and priests, you know, count on their bishops to be leaders. We need more leadership when it comes to critiquing shepherds who are doing a bad job of what they're supposed to be doing.
And one of the things this leads to, the silence of the bishops in the face of these things, is that a lot of the laity have begun to speak out. And that has become controversial in some quarters, because, like, how far should the laity go? Because when a lay person, maybe a prominent lay person, Catholic lay person, says something specifically against the bishop, then they're hammered because, like, no, you shouldn't be saying that about your, you know, the superiors, the successors to the apostles. But then when they don't say something, then it just runs rampant. And so I think a lot of lay people, and I get this myself personally, people will criticize me because I will sometimes call out bishops by name or priests by name when they do something like this. But I think it's I don't really know what the answer is, because what is the line we're supposed to draw between should we say something or should we not? And how far do we go? Because obviously, as successors of the apostles, they deserve a certain amount of respect for their office. But what should lay people look to as far as where they can draw that line or how they should criticize their
bishop? Yeah, it's a very good question, Eric. I mean, let's take the McCarrick case. You know, McCarrick was publicly identified first by the Archdiocese of New York and then by the Vatican as being a sex abuser of minors. He has never admitted his crimes. He's never begged pardon for those he offended. He pleaded innocent at his Vatican trial. He was convicted. And after being convicted, he's still claiming he's not that bad. Now he's facing very soon in March a criminal trial in Massachusetts. You know, the McCarrick case is emblematic that bishops have counted on the fact that they thought they could do whatever they want and people won't criticize them because they're bishops. There's nothing wrong with condemning McCarrick in public and then also asking the question, why was McCarrick allowed all those years to get away with further crimes or hiding his previous crimes? And yet he was, you know, protected. Things were kept quiet. I mean, Pope Benedict made a terrible mistake, in my opinion, in imposing a private penalty on McCarrick as opposed to the public penalty he got under Pope Francis. Pope Francis did the right thing in having a trial. So, you know, I love Pope Benedict. I love Pope Francis. But it's worth saying, if a pope makes a mistake, it's an act of charity to say that, not to pretend that popes don't make mistakes. That's certainly, no one would say that historically, and it applies also in the present tense.
Right. Yeah. And I want to talk about Pope Francis in a little bit, but I think like McCarrick is obviously an extreme example in one sense. I mean, I lived in DC when he was the archdiocese, when he was cardinal. And I remember there were kind of rumors. I mean, I was just a layperson. I didn't know anything at the time. And I heard, and I just thought, well, that must just be some sour grapes or something like that. But obviously if I, as a layperson, heard some of that, then other bishops and some priests may even might've heard that. But what about though, like, not necessarily a bishop who's like McCarrick level evil, but just not doing his job. He's letting things, he's just not, I mean, can lay people criticize him as well and just say, you know, Your Excellency, let's say, for example, Father James Martin is speaking in a parish in a diocese. Can we go out and just say, you know, no, you should not allow somebody like to speak? I mean, where can we draw a line on these bishops? They aren't necessarily evil, but they're just allowing evil to happen.
Well, you know, Canon 212 of the Code of Canon Law says that there's a right of all the baptized to make known their concerns, opinions, and evaluations to the hierarchy and then to their fellow Christians. So there's nothing wrong with writing to the bishop and then making public your concerns about, let's say, Father James Martin coming in to, you know, criticize Catholic teaching on homosexuality and other priests and, sad to say, even bishops now, as we heard from this Luxembourg cardinal. It's good to criticize them. And, you know, bishops who have authority should be implored to use it. You know, they have authority. And then when it comes to speaking engagements, you know, if it's in a parish church, you know, we should say parish churches are constructed so that Catholic teaching could be propagated along with all the other aspects, sacramental life, the works of charity. So if a Catholic parish is being used to promote immorality, heresy, things that are obnoxious to the will of God, the bishop should be informed of it and said, Bishop, please take steps to stop this. And, you know, let's just say we've had a number of years now where any use of discipline in the church is viewed suspiciously by those in charge. But that's part of their duty as a shepherd, which is to protect the sheep from the wolves who are out there.
I want to switch to something. There's a line in your book, Calming the Storm, that just struck me. because we're talking about, you're talking about the crisis in the church, how we react to it, how we can navigate it. And you say the first three vital steps to renewal of the church. So I, as soon as I hear this, I'm like, okay, this is kind of, here's an answer right here. But then I will admit, I was very surprised by your, by what you wrote here. Not that I don't agree with it. I just was surprised that it said, one, communion on the tongue, two, communion received kneeling, and three, the priest saying the mass facing east. I think a lot of Catholics and definitely non-Catholics would say, wait a second, that is your first three vital steps to renewal of the church. Why did you say, why do you have those three as the first three?
Well, because, you know, our essential obligation in life is to worship God, and the whole church exists for that purpose. It is through the worship of God that we then, you know, come into this living contact with him such that grace, you know, fills us and allows us to carry on works of virtue, to understand the teaching and share it. Reverence is one of the things the modern age is lacking. And certainly in the church, reverence is something that people are desperate for. They're thirsty for it. That's one of the reasons why the traditional Latin Mass has been growing so much over the last 30 years, because people find in it a reverential spirit. The Reformed liturgy of after Vatican II did not forbid communion on the tongue, communion kneeling, or ad orientem celebration of Mass, but many of those things were looked upon as being old-fashioned, need to get away from them. If we have reverence for our Lord Jesus and the Holy Eucharist, that's going to teach us about our position in the world, our relationship to our fellow man, how we should carry on our affairs. It all starts with our relationship with God, and that has to be a relationship which is based on a loving appreciation of God's goodness and coming to us, but also his greatness in calling us out of our sins and into this reverential spirit.
You know, as you were talking, that made me think that I get now, I get it a little more easily what you're saying here, the connection, because you said at the beginning that the problem is we're putting man in front of God. We're making man the center of all things, have God the center of all things. Well, all three of these things, receiving communion on the tongue, communion received kneeling, and the priest celebrating the Mass ad orientem, they all take man out of the center. They put God in the center. I've told this story before, but one of my daughters, when she was at First Communion retreat at a parish, which won't be named, but the lady who was running the retreat said basically, like, we don't receive on the tongue anymore. That's like babies. We receive in the hand. And I had already taught my kids to receive on the tongue. And I told her afterward, I didn't say anything during it, but I did talk to the pastor later. But I told my daughter, I said, she's actually exactly right. When we receive on the tongue, we are receiving like children, like little babies, because that's exactly what we are in comparison to God. And so there's that. That's why we do that. But I think it's, I think what you're saying, though, it sounds to me like these are three practical ways that we can put God at the center again, rather than man at the center.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. And yep, your daughter, that teacher was right, even though she didn't like the notion. Yeah. But you know, at a wedding, what's one of the highlights? Cutting the cake, and then it says the bride feeds the groom feeds the bride, and what do? They put the food into the mouth. Well, that's what the priest who represents Christ, the bridegroom, feeding the bride, the Christian soul who is now coming into the most intimate and strongest union with Christ through the sacrament of Holy Communion. Yeah, that's what we, I as a kid, of course, I'm a little older. We had communion kneeling and on the tongue at my first communion. And later on when they said, well, now you can receive in the hand, I never liked it. I like communion kneeling because, you know, let's face it, kneeling is a recognition of someone superior, and that's God. So, and we shouldn't be uncomfortable with that. You know, I'm amazed, you know, people will kneel for hours and end in yoga sessions and all, but they somehow they're offended if they have to kneel in church. This is a big mistake.
Yeah. And you also mentioned the ad orientem, and this has become recently a big controversy. I think a little bit oddly, in my opinion, that we've had bishops that are starting to forbid ad orientem in the Novus Ordo Mass. We're not talking about traditional Latin Mass. In just the Novus Ordo Mass, they're saying now you can't celebrate ad orientem. I don't know, maybe because it has a whiff of the traditional Latin Mass, or if it's, I'm not quite sure. It's like they're claiming it's a Vatican II thing. to ban ad orientem worship. What do you think is really behind what these bishops are doing when they do this?
Yes, no. Number one, ad orientem, meaning facing east, meaning the priest faced toward the crucifix and the tabernacle, not toward the congregation. That was Vatican II never forbade that, and the post-Vatican II liturgical documents never forbade that. It's in the current missal, it's assumed, because there are indications in the missal when the priest is supposed to turn toward the people. So that's an indication that the church doesn't forbid it. Why are some bishops doing it? I think because they don't want, it's associated with the Tridentine Mass, because the traditional Latin Mass is always said ad orientem. So if the new Mass is said ad orientem, they say, well, that's too much like that. It's a hostility to tradition and antiquity here. But it's also a profound error, because the priest is leading. This is a, you know, we talk about the image of the pilgrim people of God. Well, the priest is like Moses leading the people. And Moses is an image of Christ. The priest is the living icon of Christ. So when the priest is leading the people, it's not because he's ignoring them. He's showing them where we're going, which is toward the crucifix, which represents, of course, the incarnate God who gave himself up for us. But ad orientem is related to the resurrection, because the tradition of the church is, you know, Christ, when Christ comes a second time, he's going to come from the east. And we turn east because Jerusalem's in the east. That's where he rose. So it's not something without merit or value. And for bishops to try to forbid it is a mistake, because they're acting beyond their powers.
Right, right. Now, you brought up, of course, Vatican II. No discussion of the Christ in the church can ignore Vatican II and its impact. Now, there are a number of different kind of theories about how Vatican II, the relationship of Vatican II to the current crisis. Would you say that Vatican II, I mean, I think some of the options are it caused the crisis, the implementation kind of caused the crisis, or it just was simply already the crisis was going to happen because of the way the world was going in Vatican II. Some people would say it helped. It would be worse if not for Vatican II. Others would say, well, yes, things would have gotten bad, but Vatican II actually made it worse by pouring gasoline on the fire, or the implementation did. How would you interpret the events of Vatican II and what happened afterwards?
Well, that's a big question. We'll start with the Vatican II itself. So the documents of Vatican II are good. They are not, and there's no error taught at Vatican II. There are some doctrines which could be better explained, I think, in particular the religious liberty question, and that's been written about, you know, continuously since it was issued. But it's not erroneous in what it teaches. I don't believe any error is taught at the Council. Now, the Council, though, consisted not simply of the documents it issued. It also signified what St. John the 23rd said. We wanted to, you know, open the windows and let in the fresh air. So that analogy basically said that there was stale air in the church up to that point, and we had to let some fresh air in, meaning new ideas. Well, there's nothing wrong with new ideas. You know, what St. Thomas wrote in the 12th century was new to a lot of people, because his brilliance brought together Greek and Roman and then Christian thought all into a great summa. So new ideas per se are not a threat. Bad ideas are a threat. And that's why we need to always, you know, be orthodox and analytical from the point of view of what the church teaches. But the new idea thing then became new ways of acting, which meant old ways have to be cast aside. And that's where we got into the crisis. So I view it as the aftermath of the dynamic of the Council, that the Council put a series of expectations in people's minds that things were going to change. And then people started changing things either with or without approval. And we just descended into a cycle that we saw, you know, how many priests left the priesthood, how many nuns left the priest, left the sisterhood. Why? Well, because the old-fashioned way was no good anymore, and I'm not happy, and I don't know whether they're going to let priests marry, but I want to get married, and just on and on and on. And what did lay people experience after the Council? Mostly the changes in the liturgy, and a lot of them weren't happy. Many voted with their feet. They just stopped going. And then, you know, we saw, thank God, under St. John Paul II and Pope Benedict, in a revival of the old Mass so that people could pray in peace. Now, that's only a partial answer to a very long question. So,
yeah, I think it sounds to me like, I think this is a good way to look at it. A lot of people want to reduce the Council on the conservative side, reduce the council only to the documents and say, okay, well, it's the implementation problem, not the documents themselves. But then others on the more liberal side would say, well, we have the whole spirit of Vatican II and all that. But I do think it's somewhere in the middle there, in the sense that it's the council event. The documents are part of that event, of course, but like you said, it's expectations that were set. I mean, a great example, of course, is the teaching of birth control. Obviously, nothing in the council documents themselves said that artificial birth control was okay. But I think the whole event made it so that Catholics thought, well, we're updating things, we're letting fresh air in. So, hey, let's go ahead and allow the artificial contraception to be moral now or whatever. And of course, Paul VI didn't allow that. And so, like, I guess it's a question I know we can't completely answer, but there's a connection between the implementation though and the documents. Like, to me, I feel like the documents, you said there, you know, I agree with you, there's no heresy in them, and there's some that have some definite issues like religious liberty, but would you agree with the statement that at least at times there was passages written that were ambiguous enough to satisfy everybody to get voted on and approved, but then also ambiguous enough for lots of mischief to happen later?
Well, yes, there are. You know, there's one document, Lumen Gentium speaks about that the Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church. Yeah. Which, if understood according to the proper meaning of the word subsist in, it doesn't mean there's a distinction between the Church of Christ and the Catholic Church. But a lot of people took it to mean that, so that there was a higher thing called the Church of Christ, and the Catholic Church was a subset. And that led to a lot of ecumenical misinterpretations, where you had, you know, priests concelebrating with Protestant ministers and things of this sort, which are completely anathema. There was a minimalization often of what it means, you know, to be the one true church, you know, that it's not prideful and bold to say to someone, Protestant churches are breakaways from the Catholic Church. And while they have elements of sanctification, they lack essential elements that they were rejected at the Reformation. Many people say, oh, that's unecumenical. How can you say that? The council never contradicted it, but people took some, like the phrase about subsisting, and say, well, everybody's in the church. It's just the Catholic Church is the fullest expression. Yeah, it is the fullest expression, but it's the only fullest expression. Therefore, we say it is the Church of Christ. So that's an example. You know, one of my things I say in the book about the council is I think the spirit of the council often is a religious equivalent to the spirit at the foundation of the United Nations after the Second World War, that there was an optimistic spirit that rationality and cooperation would lead to peaceful relations in the world. And I think there was a similar spirit at the council, you know, if we just, you know, talk in a new way and act in a friendly manner, we can, you know, eliminate the schism in the Western Church. We can have Protestants reunited with Catholics, Orthodox too. And those are all good things. I hope they happen. But the result of it is that you get people who become Catholic light. They say, you know, the way we can reunite with Protestants is by basically imitating them. And that's wrong. The council never said that. That's certainly not what was intended by the fathers gathered in Rome in the early 60s.
Right. I think that idea, the optimistic spirit, that's one of the things that always struck me when I read the documents, was it just seemed to be very 1960-ish, a little bit dated, frankly, because it seemed to have too much optimism. Now, it's been almost 60 years since the council was started. It was called, of course, in 1959, but then started in 1962. So what should we do about the council today? I feel like singing the song, how do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you solve a problem like Vatican II? In the sense that I'm not saying, okay, declare Vatican II invalid, anything like that. I'm not saying that. But at the same time, some people have called for the idea that we should just move beyond Vatican II in the sense that it doesn't really help solve today's problems. And so we should really kind of forget it, even. Some have said, or at least maybe just kind of move on from it. How would you say Vatican II should be interpreted in the life of the church today? How is it useful today? And if so, how?
Well, it's useful, as are all the other general councils. I think we, like Pope Benedict said, we should not look at the council as the supra council, that it's bigger than all the other councils that ever occurred. Now, temporally, it's the closest to us. So we say it's most important because it's the one we've experienced, or at least us older guys, you know, who were around, even though I was only a kid when it started. But the answer here would be, for me, the practical thing, lay people, let's face it, by and large, are never going to read the documents, and I don't think they have to. What I recommend people read is the Catechism of the Catholic Church, because John Paul II responded to a request from bishops that an authentic and complete account of the Catholic faith be produced in light of the council teaching, but also in light of the entire patrimony of faith. And that's what this Catechism of the Catholic Church is. In fact, for me, that's one of the greatest accomplishments of the pontificate of St. John Paul II. If you read that, then you'll understand that the teaching of the church has not changed. It is the same, and it's, you know, based on the rich tradition of scriptural interpretation in the church. The Council Fathers spoke based on the theological wisdom of St. Thomas, St. Augustine, and others. But the modern dilemmas are answered in the Catechism. It is a temptation to say, after the Council, there was a disastrous loss of faith and confidence in the life of the church. The only way to get away from that is to forget about it. And I would say no. Theologians, seminarians, priests, interested lay people should read the documents, understand them properly, but then say, look, the challenge we face in the modern world, the council is not the only measure we have to repel it. We have to use the perennial theology and wisdom of the church, because we're fighting here against things. As you say, in the 60s, there was a lot of optimism. Who in the world in 1960 thought that a man could swim in a women's swimming event and be called a woman by everybody announcing it? You know, the council never considered that, but that's what we've got now. So we have to go back to, you know, Augustine, Aquinas, the Bible, Aristotle, Plato. I mean, find all that goes into human rationality and apply it.
Yeah, and I think we also acknowledge not every council is Nicaea, in the sense that, you know, Lateran V, for example, was a failed council from the 16th century. Lateran IV, I think that's the one that basically said that the Jews should, like, some persecution of Jews in certain ways. I mean, it just was like, we're not going to follow the exactly what those councils say today. Whereas Nicaea, of course, we're not going to do anything about Nicaea, obviously. But even the disciplinary canons of Nicaea, we don't necessarily have to follow exactly today. Mm. So I guess then the idea is Vatican II should be put in the perspective of one council among 21, but also 3 years and 2,000 years of history as well, correct? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, no, I mean, putting in perspective is exactly what it should happen. And that perspective should include how the council documents were misused and how the, you know, let's say the spirit of invoking a spirit of the council becomes code language for basically Protestantizing the church often. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the Protestant principle of private judgment, you know, which is clearly taught by the reformers, that each believer is given grace by God to understand the scriptures properly himself. And even if it contradicts others, that's not really a problem because God guides each one. The church has never taught that. The church teaches that the magisterium helps us to properly understand the Bible and the doctrine of the faith, and that we have to submit our judgment when it's wrong. We have to reject our judgments and submit it to the church. And yeah, it's again, the doctrine of the faith, what's crisis in the church now is not a rejection of Vatican II so much as a rejection of essential teachings of the church that we've had from the beginning. And that's really because, you know, when the bishop says and the cardinal says that homosexuality is not wrong, it's a good thing, that's a rejection of Christian anthropology as a whole, which teaches that in the creation, God gave the body a purpose. The nuptial meaning of the body, as John Paul II taught. But then we get to the Aristotelian categories of, you know, function and purpose and teleology, what something's meant for. That's all gone. This bishop wants us to just basically say, hey, you want to do this? Go right ahead. That's a combination of so many errors. It's stunning that he would say that.
Right. I want to move now over to another controversy going on in church today, and that's the traditional Latin Mass. Now, I attend the traditional Latin Mass. Now, Father, do you celebrate the traditional Latin Mass?
I do from time to time, yes.
Okay. So in general, just, I guess I just want to ask, what's your opinion of the traditional Latin Mass?
Oh, I think it's beautiful. And I was born in 1959. So I only, when I was conscious of going to Mass, it was you know, the updated version of the old Mass, you know, the 65 Missal, I guess it was. And then when I became an altar boy, it was still that. So I remember seeing the, praying the prayers at the foot of the altar in English. And then it went to the new Missal. And, you know, I didn't quite understand it all. I knew it was a little simpler and easier. But as I got older, I realized, well, hey, we got rid of a lot of stuff we never should have. So my view of it is that the liturgical reform after the council was unsuccessful because the people in charge of it made bad decisions. The updating that the Council Fathers intended was not a rewriting of the Mass. And I think, you know, the 1965 Missal had the right approach. Readings in the vernacular are a good thing, and certain other parts in the vernacular, but maintaining the Latin as a whole and then maintaining the liturgical, you know, rubrical structure as a whole rather than getting rid of it. So, you know, I'm one of those people that thinks we should redo at some point. The church should re-examine the reform of the Mass after the council and return to a much more conservative and traditional reform that was, I think, what the Council Fathers intended.
Right, because when Pope Benedict issued his motu proprio, Summorum Pontificum, that was basically liberalizing the celebration of the traditional Latin Mass, making it easier for priests to do so. One of the things he seemed to be saying was he wanted the two forms, as he called them, the extraordinary form and the ordinary form, to infect each other, so to speak, in good ways. Infect's probably not the best word. Influence each other.
Influence, yeah.
Yeah, influence each other in good ways. And it sounds like that's somewhat of a saying similar to what you're saying, like the initial reforms to the Mass, like 1965 and stuff, where you're basically keeping the traditional Latin Mass as is, but you are maybe adding the vernacular in certain places, maybe doing a few other minor changes, and that's it. That's almost what he's looking for. But now Pope Francis, of course, has issued Traditionis Custodis, and it seems like he's explicitly saying, as I understand, he's explicitly saying that the ultimate goal should be just the Novus Ordo Mass, and that's it. That should be the only form of the Roman Rite. And what do you think about the Pope's efforts to basically squash the traditional Latin Mass?
Yes, I regret that the Pope issued Traditionis Custodes because I consider that he made a mistake because he said that the people who attend or many of the people who attend the Mass are often causes of disunity in the church, and therefore the unity of the church is threatened by continuing to have the traditional Latin Mass. Therefore, everyone should return to the new order of the Mass. And I think that judgment is just erroneous. In my experience, most Latin Mass goers that I've met are very grateful to Popes John Paul II and Benedict for what they did. And they believe as Catholics that that's what they're supposed to do. They did not continue or go to the Society of St. Pius X, which is canonically irregular. They go to the fraternity and other parishes. And then, you know, I think that's where we are supposed to be. And Pope Francis's concerns have led to, you know, people being treated very roughly, that their causes of problems in the church, and bishops are forbidding the Latin Mass completely in their diocese. This is not what Pope Francis said, by the way, even if his long-term goal is that. He didn't say that we're going to stop all these Masses now. I was pleased. The Fraternity of St. Peter just came out with a press release stating that two of their leading priests met with the Pope, and he said that they are most welcome to continue to be what they are and use all the liturgical books from 1962. So we're getting mixed signals from the Pope. You know, if it's okay for the fraternity priest to say the old Mass and have confirmation and confession in the old Rite, why can't the diocesan priest also do it? You know, this is where, as a canon lawyer, you begin to get into a discussion about consistency in law and practice.
Right. And it just seems crazy, though, the idea that the Pope could say this Mass has to be restricted when it's a Mass that literally millions of people have gone to for hundreds of years. I mean, even going back organically, you know, past the time of St. Gregory the Great. And how can this be? How can the traditional Latin Mass be something that's considered a bad thing in the Catholic Church? How is that even possible?
I think it was a mistake in judgment. You know, Pope Francis decided to become a priest as a young man when the old mass was being celebrated. You know, that's how he made his first communion. And certainly, you know, it nourished the faith of generations and was not a cause of any harm to the church. The problem is, of course, the liturgical reformers often were influenced by Protestant ideas, and they looked at traditional worship forms as being antiques that need to be cast aside. They didn't like the use of Latin. They wanted contemporary music. They considered the Ad Orientem style to be, you know, let's say too hierarchical or too mystical. They wanted essentially a Protestant notion of, you know, table fellowship. And, you know, it's just there was a distinct and more Protestantized version of the Holy Eucharist that inspired, I think, many of the changes, which were mistakes. And having the Latin Mass around is a constant reminder that people don't buy into that.
Right. Now, do you think a bishop who forbids his priest to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass, or even forbids his priest to celebrate the Novus Ordo Mass Ad Orientem, if he's overstepping his authority, can a priest defy that, and or are they violating their vow of obedience if they defy that and go ahead and celebrate the traditional Latin Mass anyway, or celebrate Ad Orientem when the bishop says not to?
Right. Well, we'll take each one in turn. For the old Mass, the traditional Latin Mass, the priest does need the permission of the diocesan bishop, and he's not entitled to disobey. If he's denied the permission, then he needs to use the canonical recourses available in canon law for priests who feel that their rights or good, you know, something good is being harmed by an episcopal action. So they should ask the bishop to issue a decree. They should have what's called recourse, which means that you ask the bishop to withdraw the decree. If he refuses, then you contact the Congregation for Divine Worship in Rome and say, my bishop is unfairly denying me this permission. The stated reasons he gave for it don't apply, etc. As regards Ad Orientem, the bishop doesn't have the power to forbid that. I know bishops are doing that, but it's not in their power to do it. So again, if the bishop tells you you can't do it, fine. You say, please issue a decree informing me of this, stating the reasons why you're forbidding it. And then I'm going to have canonical recourse and again, go to the congregation in Rome. Now, in the meantime, you're going to have a dispute on whether the fact that you're making a recourse suspends the effective date of these forbidding things. And that's where you can get into a dispute. In general, it's good to go along with the bishop until you get vindicated either by him or by the higher level, meaning that you're going to win the case. But you know, I don't like disobedient priests because that's not, you know, what Jesus intended the apostles to do, you know, to be disobey him or to have the priests under them be disobedient. But you have to use the canonical rights you have to kind of vindicate when your rights are being stepped on.
So ultimately, though, if let's say you go through all the canonical forms and it goes up to Congregation of Divine Worship and they say, no, you can't celebrate, let's say the Latin, let's say the traditional Latin Mass, then you would argue then that the priest just, that he's just going to have to just celebrate the Novus Ordo and he just can't celebrate the traditional Latin Mass. He can then
say, well, I'm leaving this diocese. I'll go to a place where the bishop will give me permission or I'll join the fraternity of St. Peter. You can also say, well, I'm going to dedicate my life to continuing to pray and work that this be reversed, this decision, you know, by the Congregation of Divine Worship. It's, you know, when something is good in and of itself, the fact that the authority forbids it doesn't mean that he's established that it's wrong and bad. He's just, he doesn't like it and he's using his power to suppress it. So, you know, stand firm, but I don't recommend disobedience because that undermines the whole church. And that really is a threat against the unity of the church.
Okay. Okay, let's move on. One more specific thing I want to talk about is, of course, is Pope Francis, which we've talked about before already. Obviously, he's at the center of this storm in many ways, being the Pope. Obviously, he is. But I think, you know, I think a lot of people would argue that he's causing some of the storm. He's kicking up the sand, to use the sandstorm analogy. He's kicking up the sand somewhat, so to speak. What's your honest assessment overall of the pontificate of Francis?
Well, Pope Francis's pontificate has been marked by some troubling actions where he contradicted previous teaching of the church. And in particular, Amoris Laetitia, he endorses the notion that there are some people who are in invalid second marriages meaning they're validly married to someone, but they're living together and cohabiting with a second person, that those people can be granted the reception of Holy Communion. That is a complete rejection of the church's teaching, which goes back to the beginning. This was never an idea anywhere in the tradition of the church that people who were living in an adulterous union were entitled to receive communion, or that the ministers of the church, the priests, should give communion to those people. So the Pope used the occasion of Amoris Laetitia in a famous footnote to state this. And then people said, well, is it sure that he really meant that? Well, then some bishops around the world started issuing documents saying exactly that, that some people in these so-called second unions could be allowed communion. And the Pope endorsed them, including the bishops in the Buenos Aires region. The Maltese bishops issued a document to that effect, published in the Osservatore Romano. The Maltese, the Argentine document actually appears in the in the Acta Apostolica Sedis, which is the official official publication of the Vatican for magisterial teaching. So that the death penalty is another area. The Pope has said that it's immoral and that it offends human dignity. This has never been the teaching of the church. I know it's not popular in modern world and certainly in European liberal circles and elsewhere to say that the death penalty is good. The death penalty is good because it's part of the order that God established. You know, the God in the Old Testament commanded the death penalty for certain crimes. Was God offending human dignity? Of course not. We would never say that. And if you look at St. Thomas Aquinas and other writers, they explain the reason why the death penalty is moral. It's a legitimate use of punitive power for serious crimes. So those are two areas where he's caused a lot of problems, in my opinion. And it's not disrespectful to the Pope to say, Holy Father, I do not see how your teaching conforms with that of your predecessors. It may be viewed as offensive and rude, but that's just a subjective way of looking at it. If anyone can show me how communion for adulterers and the immorality of the death penalty is justified in Catholic tradition and teaching, maybe I'll change my opinion. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think this has caused, those are probably the best two examples. And of course, he said other things that on a plain reading seem wrong. I mean, just recently he had the thing where he talked about the apostates and blasphemers are also part of the communion of the saints. And it's like, I know you can kind of maybe twist some of these to try to make it work, but it seems like to the average Catholic who reads it, hears them, they just take it to mean what it says. And there's never a clarification given later either by the Vatican to say, okay, well, actually, no, he really meant this, or at least rarely is. Now, because of this, there's been a sizable portion of faithful Catholics who have begun to wonder whether or not he's even the Pope. And the reason is because there is church teaching in the past that a heretic can't be a pope. St. Bellarmine, some others. But of course, there's a lot of nuances to that. Just to be clear, so you know, I think Francis is the Pope. But I do think, I understand, though, talking about confusion again, that clearly what the Pope is saying at times on its plain reading is heretical. And so some people then jump to that to say, well, then the Pope is a heretic. Well, then that means he's not the Pope. And some people would say Benedict's the Pope. So others would just say we don't have a Pope. How would you respond to people who are struggling with this? I mean, clearly he's contradicting previous teaching. What does that mean as far as his papacy?
Right. Well, no, I don't. I believe Pope Francis is the true Pope. The question of whether he's endorsed heretical views, that's something we should debate. That's something that people are debating. On that issue you brought up where he said apostates are part of the communion of the saints, you know, as speaking from a sacramental perspective, anyone who's baptized is always in some way united to the communion of all the baptized. Now, you can lose that union through becoming an apostate, meaning rejecting Christ, but you can't unbaptize yourself. So there's a sense in which you're always united, even in the most tenuous way. You know, other things have been said, like where he talked about in the Abu Dhabi statement that he signed, that God willed the other religions of the world. The Catholic Church rejects that. We say there's only one true church. It was revealed by God the Savior came into the world. So now the question is, can someone, you know, being the Pope is a juridical reality. In other words, you get elected to it and it's publicly, it's a public act that's recognized by the people who have the responsibility in law to do that. And he was validly elected Pope. How do you lose that? You either die or resign. You know, those are the ways, of course, that you stop being Pope. Can you lose it automatically by becoming a heretic? Well, that would mean you'd be a heretic as recognized canonically as being a heretic, which means you would be obstinate persistence in an error, grave error. And that's an automatic excommunication attached to heresies. So, but the question is, in church law, that penalty, it can be freely assumed by those who rejoice in the fact that they're heretics. They say, yes, I do freely reject that. You know, Martin Luther, et cetera, people who are public heretics. Someone who doesn't believe they're committing heresy and just think they're doing a variation on a doctrine, you know, then it's hard to say whether they've got the automatic penalty. And there's nobody to confirm whether the Pope has gotten an automatic penalty. I mean, just in theory, apart from this Pope, you know, who's going to confirm that? Now, Father Fessio asked a question years ago, what if the Pope became a Muslim, you know, which is ridiculous on its face, but it's not impossible, you know, in the absolute sense. Well, in that case, you know, it would be clear that the Pope, he would reject that such a thing as a papacy even exists as part of God's will. So that would be clear. But someone who says that meaning of the church teaching has been poorly understood or not properly applied, that's more difficult to come up with. But again, it's an area for discussion, and it's something that's going to be pursued apart from this pontificate. It's a canonical question. We treat it in canon law school, and you know, the answer given in a classroom, it becomes hard to apply it in the real world.
Right. So there really isn't, it sounds like there isn't really a canonical answer to the question of a situation where a Pope is a heretic. He's not resigning. He's not dying. Like who, and the it's very clear the Pope is judged by no one. I mean, that's been canonical tradition for centuries. Who would actually then be able to declare, okay, he's a heretic, this Pope is a heretic, therefore he's no longer Pope? Would it be the College of Cardinals? Would it be an ecumenical council? I mean, because that sounds like it's putting them above him, but if he's a heretic, then maybe he's not. I mean, it sounds like, would you say that it's not really, there's not really an answer to that question?
Well, no one can declare it has juridical effect, meaning it has a legal effect to deprive him of the pontificate. Certainly the cardinals could gather in totality or partially and say, this teaching is heretical. You've issued this teaching. Do you understand why it's heretical? If you realize your error, we want you to publicly repent. The Pope could say, go get out of here. I don't agree with you, et cetera, et cetera. The Pope might say, you know, you're right, and I'm going to quit the pontificate because I don't believe there is such a thing. You know, that could happen. But again, it's theoretical. There is no one stands in judgment of the Pope because he is the supreme authority on earth.
Okay, I want to wrap it up here, but I want to, my last question I want to ask is, do you have advice? Most people who watch and listen to this podcast are just your typical lay Catholics in the pews. They're not priests. They're not working for a diocese, anything like that. What can they do? What can we do that in during this crisis, during the storm, what's the best things we can do to try to navigate it?
Yeah, well, number one, have a serious prayer life, you know, attend Mass weekly, certainly on Sundays, if not every day. Study the faith. I think every adult Catholic should read the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I think every Catholic should read the whole Bible starting with the Old Testament if possible. But if it's too hard, read the New Testament first, and then maybe you'll be interested enough to go back. But, you know, prayer, study, and then maintain a calm spirit, which trusts in God's providence. You know, the fact that we have unfaithful shepherds in the church, you know, bishops like that cardinal in Luxembourg, that doesn't mean, oh, I'm out of here. This church can't be the true church because we got people like this. No, I mean, meditate on Judas. Meditate on one of the closest people to our Lord during the 3 years of his public ministry with the 12 apostles, and Judas was one of them. And what did he do? So, you know, and then pray for your bishops and your priests, pray for the Pope, because, yeah, it's the answer is not to say, I'm out of here, I'm fed up. No, the answer is say, I'm going to double down on being a faithful Catholic.
That's very good advice. I just want to recommend people, I will link to it in the show notes, but the book is Calming the Storm, Navigating the Crises Facing the Catholic Church and Society from Emmaus Road Publishing. Like I said, I'll link to it. Now, I believe it's not yet out. Do you know what the publication date is?
Right. It's not out until April 7th is the Amazon date. Emmaus Road Press also has the website at stpaulcenter.com, and you can order it there. And they're offering the benefit if you pre-order a copy, which will be out hopefully by April 7th, but they'll send you now the electronic version so you can get a head start on reading it. But yeah, by the beginning of April, this book will be out in the public domain.
Great. So if you don't mind reading on a device, then you can get it. You can start reading it right now. You can order it from St. Paul Center, which is, who runs Emmaus Road Publishing. But then the paperback, or is it
hardcover? No, it's a hardcover.
Hardcover. Okay. Hardcover will be available then in April. So I just encourage everybody to pick up the book. And thank you, Father, very much for being part of the podcast.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay. Until next time, everybody. God love you.